Good morning. May it please the Court, Becky Walker-James for the defendant Scott Walker, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Although there's a multitude of complex procedural issues in our briefs, this case is really boils down to a very simple issue. Mr. Walker was charged and convicted of a crime of which it is now clear he was not guilty, and he was actually innocent. The government nevertheless seeks to salvage his conviction by saying, well, he's procedurally barred from raising this claim because he needed to show that he was also actually innocent of other charges that were not included in the indictment with which he was never charged, relying on a declaration from the prosecutor saying that the prosecutor forewent those charges during the
But not rely on the declaration. Relying here on a finding of fact by the district court that that happened.
Well, a finding of fact that was based on the declaration without holding an evidentiary hearing. And so one of the problems in this case was that to the extent that there was evidence presented by way of declaration of the prosecutor, there was never an evidentiary hearing, never an opportunity to cross-examine the prosecutor, never an opportunity to present.
At what point did your side ask for the opportunity to cross-examine Tavachi?
Oh, I think Mr. Welker did. I mean, he asked for the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing present.
I don't quite understand evidence. What's going on here. What do you want us to do? What are you asking us to do, and where does that put your client if you're successful?
Well, ideally, he would like to have the writ granted on the ground that he is actually innocent of the one charge of which he was convicted.
But then where does he go, and what happens then? Then is he facing a bank fraud charge?
And no.
Does he lose his 3 points for acceptance of responsibility?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the case.
Well, you're trying to go back to square one, right? And that would face him with a possible bank fraud charge, facing 30 years, not just 20.
Well, but it's
and
not
he loses
clear.
His acceptance of responsibility. So it seems to me that you're walking your client backwards. I don't mean this as criticism. Right into a worse situation.
Well, I don't think that at this point we would go back to.
But you would. That's what you're asking us to do: is undo the plea and go back. And so all of a sudden, now your client's facing the bank fraud charge.
Well,
it gets no acceptance of responsibility.
Well, at this point, if you look at this court's case law that has addressed situations similar to this, such as in the Bailey context. The remedy is if the charge as to which the defendant is convicted is invalid, the conviction is dismissed. I don't think you go back.
But you got to be careful because I think what you're doing is walking right back into, okay, let's start over again.
Well, the government has never asked for that.
That's what happens.
Well, I would submit that it does not, Your Honor. I think the proper remedy
is. What case says that's not what happens?
Well,
what case says you win?
Well, if you look at Romero, for example, where the government did not charge a carry theory. They were not allowed then to go back and re-indict him on a carry theory. The conviction is reversed.
I don't understand how you can argue he's actually innocent. I mean, his own statement filed with the court says, the behavior that I exhibited was one of lack of regard for the company and the people I worked for. I regret any harm that I caused. My actions were done out of pure selfishness to support a lifestyle of excessive spending and excessive drinking. And it falls right within the bank fraud allegations that could have been brought. And a finding of fact by the district court that they could have been brought and they were deliberately foregone during the negotiation phase.
That could have been brought but were not brought. And the court's finding that they were negotiated away, again, was based on an untested declaration. And as to the charge that was brought on a services fraud, it's clear that, and really undisputed, that he's not guilty of that charge.
Let's go back to the statement you made that really all that was there is this declaration by Mr. Tavachi. You've got a plea colloquy in which the factual basis of that plea colloquy, I think a fair reading, indicates he's acknowledging that he engaged in at least wire fraud. And then you have the PSR that has a paragraph that recounts the offense conduct. That all, and there's no objection to it as I understand it, and that also provides a factual basis at least for wire fraud, if not for bank fraud. So it's more than just Mr. Tabachi's declaration that the government could have proven wire fraud and bank fraud.
Well, I think there's two issues there. One issue is, were these charges that fall within the Bowsley language about more serious charges that were foregone in exchange for a guilty plea? And that's really what Mr. DiBacci's declaration goes to. There's nothing in the factual basis or the PSR that addresses that issue. The only language in the plea agreement that addresses that issue is boilerplate language in paragraph 17H that says they agree not to further prosecute. But there's no specific...
No, the factual basis your client admits to. He admits to paying personal expenses from the accounts of his of the coffee specialty association. He admits to it. And he admits to arranging for the transfer of those funds. Doesn't he walk right into wire fraud?
Well, no, not necessarily, because there's really no misrepresentation or deception in there. What he admits to is arguably theft, but there's no deceptive course of conduct in that factual basis. And similarly with bank fraud, there's nothing to show that a bank was defrauded in his factual basis, or that the banks were federally insured. There's not even a mention of the banks. So and other circuits have held that just, you know, an unauthorized wire transfer or writing a check without authorization does not constitute bank fraud, and that makes sense because it's not a fraud against the bank. It's if anything, it is just an unauthorized use of someone else's funds. So, but again, getting back to the issues of what offenses can the court look at? What did he have to prove his actual innocence of? The government looks at this language in Bowsley about more serious charges, dismissal of more serious charges or foregone charges that were more serious, and wants to extend that to equally serious charges. But
why is it equally? I mean, it's charges, not punishment. And if you look at the statutes, one is more serious than the other.
Right, only in the sense of the statutory maximum.
But how else, what other than a statutory maximum could we use? I mean, you make the point that they're both covered under 2B1.1 of the guidelines. Okay, that's fine, but then do we go and look at the base offense level? How is that a workable comparison? It has to be the statutory maximum, doesn't it, to make an objective, easy to determine criteria for what's more serious than another?
I think looking at the guideline range is a very workable solution, and it's the most sensible solution.
It's different in every case. How would you? What does the guideline range is meaningless unless you apply it in a particular case? So, if you're going to try to determine which is the more serious offense, it's got to be something that is clear and easy to draw. And I submit to you, a guideline calculation is going to be a very problematic criteria to use to make that determination.
Especially now that it's not binding.
Perhaps, but it still remains the fact that DOJ policy requires prosecutors to charge and not bargain away.
Bowsley says charges, not punishment.
Yes, it does. And in evaluating what is the most serious charge under DOJ policy, the U.S. Attorney's Manual instructs prosecutors to look at the sentencing guidelines.
You can't use the manual to bind the government. You know that. I mean, there's Supreme Court cases all over the place on that.
No, but I think if you look at what Bowsley is interested in, they're looking at the plea bargaining process.
So they could change the manual next week.
Well, but the point is, I think we're looking at what would the government have bargained. What was the government bargaining away? What benefit did Mr. Welker receive? What was the government bargaining away? And if he is likely to receive the same sentence under any of these charges, then there really isn't a benefit or a windfall there one way or the other.
And your argument is that if you can set aside this plea, everything goes away.
Yes, that would be our position, Your Honor. That's the one charge he faces, and it is now invalid. And I would like to remain the remaining minute for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Curtis Kinn on behalf of the United States. Bowsley is very clear that if the government did forego charges, then the defendant needs to be actually innocent of those charges. And in this particular case, as the Court has pointed out through its questioning, there are charges that the government did forego here, which is money and property wire fraud, which is made out by the factual basis in the plea agreement, as well as bank fraud.
Where is the bank fraud reflected? Other than Mr. DiBacci's statement that he was considering bank fraud charges and he forewent them, the factual basis in the plea colloquy and in the PSR, how does that support a bank fraud charge?
I think there's two things, if I can answer there, Your Honor. First of all is in terms of what did the government forego, it's not simply the Tabachi Declaration that we look at. In fact, 17H of the plea agreement itself, I think, makes out what the government did, in fact, forego. This court has made very clear, as has the Supreme Court, that plea agreements need to look like and looked at like contracts. You look at this plea agreement in its contractual language, 17H, in connection with his factual basis, shows that the government will not further prosecute defendant based on the defendant's conduct described in the factual
right,
basis.
Right, but the factual basis, then, we link back to that. And does the factual basis set forth a facts that would support a bank fraud charge?
Yes, Your Honor, insofar as I think we have to look at it differently, insofar as the factual basis makes out what it is that the government has foregone and what it cannot prosecute him for. It doesn't need to make out every element, and I think there's a difference between the factual basis for the purpose of what it is that the government decided to forego.
Well, how are we supposed to know what the government chose to forego if you don't put it on the record or in the plea agreement?
I think, Your Honor,
you can't. You're asking us to basically read in from things that aren't there.
Not at all, Your Honor.
What's in the record that supports bank fraud?
Well, the plain terms of the plea, in terms of whether the government decided or did forego bank fraud, the plea agreement 17H in connection with paragraph 9 make that out, because it's broadly read as not to further prosecute defendant based on the conduct described in there. If you think about
where does it pull the bank into the plea agreement?
It does not in that regard, except for...
That's what Judge Thomas is driving at.
Well, in terms of whether we forewent it, I think if the defendant was to use that non-prosecution provision, if the government after this case had decided, you know what, we're going to go ahead and prosecute him for bank fraud on top of the crime he just did, he certainly could use that as a shield. In fact, I think that provision clearly would bar the government from further prosecuting him from bank fraud. So
why?
In this context...
I just don't get that. First of all, the word bank fraud only appears in the declaration. It doesn't appear in the plea agreement. The plea agreement just says we're foregoing of the charges based on what he said, and what he said doesn't relate to bank fraud. So maybe I'm misconnecting with what you're saying.
No, Your Honor. I think that the provision of the plea agreement does encompass bank fraud. Insofar as there is any doubt as to that, I think the Tabachi Declaration gets us there the rest of the way. He says, look, in terms of this non-prosecution agreement, the charges that the government, in fact, did forego was wire fraud as well as bank fraud.
Well, that's
fraud
what
here.
He said. I mean, the question is, though, comes back to the lack of an evidentiary hearing, because what he said doesn't match up with what I see on paper.
Well, in that regard, Your Honor, looking at what the district court's decision is the district court didn't rely solely on the Tabachi Declaration. In fact, if you look at the district court's decision, which is that 17H, in connection with the factual basis, makes out an obligation for the government not to be able to prosecute him from anything arising out of that conduct, which included bank fraud. As a result, then, the Tabachi Declaration simply clarified that among the things that this plea agreement already establishes is bank fraud.
That's sort of a circular argument. Gets us back. He didn't. There's no bank fraud in what he said. In the facts that were pleaded, 17H refers to the facts alleged and developed at during the colloquy.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the record actually does support. In fact, there is bank fraud. Looking at the factual basis as well, it makes out the fact that this is the defendant who was. There's no doubt stealing from his employer. 1344 Section 2 of the bank fraud statute encompasses any fraud that is designed to take money out of the custody and care and control of the bank. It doesn't necessarily have to be a fraud directed at the bank. In that regard, also, I would point out that defendant relies on out-of-circuit cases for this sort of restricted view of the bank fraud statute, but I think that this court's opinion on 1344.2, a bank fraud theory in McNeil, 320 F3rd 1034, makes clear that bank fraud encompasses frauds designed to defraud third parties, here the defendant's employer, where the money was in the custody and care and control of the bank, so long as the course of fraudulent conduct was in some way directed towards the bank or the deception included bank activities. Here, in the factual basis, as well as RSU included in the indictment, the defendant was writing checks to himself, made unauthorized wire transfers. He was transferring money from one account to the other to conceal his fraud. He was opening a line of credit to cover his losses. And moreover, under Bowsley, we're allowed to look at evidence outside the record. And if you look at it, GSER 165, it's very clear from the internal report of the CSA director that the defendant had in fact falsified loan documents. So he had directed his fraud at Union Bank to create a line of credit to help hide his tracks. At GSER 180, there's the interview statement of the bank officer himself, says false statements were made to me by the defendant, again, to obtain this line of credit. Had he not lied about his ability to get this line of credit, we would not have given him this line of credit. So again, you've got a fraud here, as well as one that impacts the bank.
And was there a request for an evidentiary hearing?
I think the record reflects that there was a request for, not a formal request for an evidentiary hearing, but certainly I think in the papers in the district court, the pro se defendant does complain that he never had the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Tabachi.
Does he or does anybody on his behalf submit a declaration that says bank fraud or anything or wire fraud or something like that never came up?
No, Your Honor. The only thing that to that effect, I believe, is the statement by the defendant, and not a declaration, Your Honor, but a statement by the defendant that if we had had a hearing, I would have had my defense counsel in the trial court, Nathan Hockman, state that the indictment had already been filed and the government never threatened to bring a superseding indictment. That is actually consistent with the government.
Now, let's suppose for a second that we rule against you. What happens to this case? The other side says it evaporates. In your view, it would be what?
Problematically, Your Honor, I believe it does evaporate because we're well beyond the statute of limitations. And while I haven't gotten into creative tolling arguments here, I might be hard-pressed to come up with them. That's exactly what Bowsley is about, is the party should be put in the position that they were, that they had bargained upon originally. Because at this point in time, we're barred from the statute of limitations. We're barred from holding him responsible for the fraudulent conduct that he does not dispute, that he stole money from his employer.
Right, but I think Judge Sharp was asking a more specific question.
Right.
If we credit your opponent's argument, your view is we just grant the writ and the conviction is vacated, and then the United States has to make a decision.
I'm afraid that's right, Your Honor.
There's no remand for further proceedings.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. And I think that is a serious consequence. This is a fraud that the defendant, in fact, did perpetrate that he doesn't dispute.
Well, it's a nice segue when you use the word serious, because now we should, in your last couple of minutes, please address the argument that this is not a more serious charge.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If we're talking about bank fraud, which the government did forego, the court need not even address that issue because of the 30-year statutory maximum clearly makes it more serious. I think as the court's earlier questions indicated, statutory maximum is really the only practical approach. I would actually add one more thing.
But if bank fraud's off the table, then where would we be left with?
I still think, though, that more serious encompasses equally serious. In that regard, I do point this court to the Seventh Circuit's opinion by Judge Posner in Lewis versus Peterson. That, compared to all of the other cases cited in the defendant's brief, is the only court to have, and essentially was en banc, because it's clear that Judge Posner had circulated amongst the entire judges there of the Seventh Circuit, but it's the only court to
address. Why is that clear?
At the very tail end, Judge Posner notes that because there is a different circuit, the Eighth Circuit, that seems to have a contrary opinion pursuant to
that's not en banc. It's a Seventh Circuit procedure.
Yeah, smaller circuits do that all the time.
Sure, Your Honor. But the point being also, though, is it was looked at by numerous judges, and moreover, it seems to be the only court's opinion that really addresses this issue, does more serious, encompass equally serious. And I would also say that Bowsley...
get there. I mean, the language in Bowsley is more serious. I mean, it doesn't... It's not a very ambiguous phrase. So what does the Seventh Circuit say? Why do they think they can rewrite that sentence to say equal?
Let me answer it by first talking about
Bowsley. Because it's Posner.
That may be some of it, Your Honor. But if you look at the Bowsley opinion itself, right after the court makes the proclamation that it needs to be more serious foregone charges, what does the court do? It turns around and it actually addresses whether the United States government can proceed on a carry theory under 924C. Under 924C, under the stat mac, 924C, a carry theory is equally serious, not ever more serious than a use theory. Under 924C, use is either 5, or in the form of brandishing or discharging, it's going to be 7 or 10 years. Carry is always going to be the 5 years. So it seems that if the court had really had meant to make
so they didn't mean what they said.
Well, I think it meant
more. Is that the way we're supposed to approach the Supreme Court opinions?
Well, Your Honor, I do think that in more serious, it's very clear that in making that pronouncement, the court did not, no pun intended, seriously address that particular issue. I think what it was concerned with is what exactly the Seventh Circuit said, which is if, in fact, we're going to try to put the parties in the position they were when they bargained for this, is there a charge that's going to support the serious sentence that he got? And certainly a less serious charge, I think we all admit, would unfairly prejudice the defendant. But if it's only more serious charges, I think that would unfairly prejudice the government in that
Why?
Bargain. Because if they're an equally serious charge, would also have supported the sentence and gotten us to where, gotten this district court and everybody to where they had a bargain to be. If you take away equally serious, then you have essentially the defendant sort of a windfall in that regard. And I think in that regard, Judge Posner was right in interpreting more serious encompasses equally serious. And I think the Supreme Court Bowsley decision is in fact consistent with that because of the fact that the court went on to address the carry theory. And it wouldn't have done so unless it assumed that if it had been appropriately charged, that the carry theory would have been sufficient. So for those reasons, I think then that equally or more serious is appropriate.
Okay. Great. Thank you for your argument. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking up on the last point first, I mean, I think we have to assume that the Supreme Court means what it says, and it clearly said more serious, and that really does make sense. When
so do as we say, not do as we do?
Well, right. I think that, you know, we should assume that they do know how to say what they mean, and they said more serious for a reason. And I think the reason has to be that it does go to this issue of plea bargaining and ensuring that there is not some unfairly gained, you know, benefit through this process.
But if it's equally serious, the government has elected to forego a charge. It's made an election. What's wrong with the logic of saying that's sufficient?
Well, in that case, there's really, it's just an election. It's an election that the government has to make all the time. What cases are they going to bring? What charges are they going to bring? They've made an election. There's no benefit that the defendant has bargained for by, you know, or the government has bargained for by getting this plea in exchange for dropping a more serious charge that the defendant then gets to keep.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it's not the same sort of equities when you're talking about equal serious.
The defendant
charges.
Right here is an example of how there is a benefit to it. I mean, if there are additional charges, then on appeal, if one charge goes away, the conviction would remain in place. So a defendant does get a benefit out of foregoing even an equally serious charge.
Well, perhaps, but he didn't get any benefit in that sense in the plea agreement. So, the government can easily guard against that by having the plea entered to the multiple charges. But they did not do that here. And I'd also just like to address the points about the loan documents on bank fraud briefly. Those documents, just to be clear, were only submitted by the government after the fact in the 2255 proceedings. They were not part of the original record.
What difference does that make? Bowsley says you could go outside of the record.
Right, but in an evidentiary hearing. Bowsley contemplates an evidentiary hearing with admissible evidence and specifically refers to admissible evidence. These are interview reports of the SCAA executive director. So, again, totally untested proof. So if the government had wanted to prove up the bank fraud in this evidentiary hearing, Bowsley does allow for that to address this situation of putting the government back in it, putting the parties back in the place they were. But the remedy for that is doing an evidentiary hearing, not
well,
just
suppose
documents.
We take, I mean, the middle ground on this is the remand for an evidentiary hearing, but really what do you hope to gain by it? I assume that the government's agents will testify consistent with the affidavit. We don't see any evidence to the contrary that there was not these two bank fraud and wire fraud were not on the table at one point.
Well, I don't think we can just assume that, Your Honor. I mean, I think, you know, Mr. Walker would like the evidentiary hearing and would like the opportunity to test the government's evidence on those charges, and I think he is entitled to that.
Okay.
The court has no further questions.
Thank you for your argument. The case is heard will be submitted for decision. Next case, United States versus Mendoza, submitted on the briefs, and we'll proceed with argument in Halleck versus L3 Communications Corporation.